Hello and welcome to our program, About Books, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Kathleen Schock with co-host
Lana Collins.
And during the next half hour, we will be reading articles from the San Antonio Express News and talking about
books, and more books. Well, this morning, we are going to begin with a tragic accident that haunts a little girl in the book titled Poor Deer. The imaginary creature serves as a fairy tale conscious as the truth unfolds. The book, again, as I said, is titled Poor Deer. It's written by Claire Oshetsky, published by ECHO, that's E-C-O, and 240 pages at a cost of $26.99. Our review is by Ellen Atkins, who writes for the Washington Post. Poor dear, Margaret's mother says about their neighbor, whose little girl, Agnes, has gone to a, quote, better place, unquote. But what four-year-old Margaret hears is, quote, poor deer, unquote. And so the title, Creature of Claire Oshetsky's novel, enters Margaret's life and stays. 12 years on, when Margaret, hunkered down at Little Ida's motor lodge, is telling us this story. Poor deer is hovering at her shoulder, acting as a sort of copy editor of conscience. She tells the girl, quote, stop stalling. It's time to confess what you did, unquote. The, quote, confession, unquote, that follows the story, Poor Deer, tales is a cautionary tale as old as time, or at least as old as the defunct cooler that Agnes decides to hide in, one with a hasp Margaret can't work, prompting a, quote, so dark and so extreme that she ran home and hid under the table, unquote. Before arriving at this version of the story, the truth, she insists, Margaret tries out some self-absolving variations, only to be scolded by poor dear. Quote, you've told it all wrong. Again, you little monster, unquote. Oshetsky, also the author of Chohute, paints Margaret as a peculiar child, towing the fine line between precocious and precious. By the age of 4, she has taught herself to read, likes to sit under the table, poring over a compendium of fairy tales, savoring the happy endings, and making up some of her own to, quote, help her forget that singular moment in her life when everything went so wrong, unquote. She, quote, writes her stories down in her own made-up secret ciphers, unquote, and keeps them in a shoebox under her bed. An unlikely heroine, and like David Copperfield, Margaret wonders more than once whether she will be the hero of her own story. Quote, she moves like a blind bear, knocking into things and lumbering off in unlikely directions. Margaret can never decide if the shapes moving toward her are people or angels or dogs or deer or wolves, but she has other skills, unquote. The world she bumbles through is brooded over by a big mill whose, quote, smokestacks rise up like turrets. The smoke churning out the top settles over the houses like a soft sulfurous gauze. The sky is perpetual yellow. The houses are all the same. The streets are mostly unpaved. There are many churches. There are many believers. The boundary between the practical and the supernatural is razor thin, and the air is filled with indistinguishable flying things, snow flurries, low-throated planes, buckshot, chaotic flocks of birds, unquote. This is the unpromising setting for what Margaret, now a teenage mill worker, on the lam, looks back on as her, quote, incantatory wanderings, unquote, the way she collects words like spells. On the fateful day at the center of the story, when Agnes's antics prompt an old woman's ire, quote, insouciant little girl, unquote, the epithet immediately enters Margaret's runic lexicon, joining, quote, words strung out like unmatched beads on a wire, testify, glorious, stuttering, and other fine words made up or real, applesauce, peppermint, hot diggity dog, unquote. In Poor Dear, we are in a fairy tale territory, but in that fraught space between the Disney version and the Grimm, and Margaret's story attempts to reconcile the two, to put the terrors of unfairness of her little life into a bearable perspective, as fairy tales do. If the little match girl in the end, quote, flew upwards in brightness and joy far above the earth, where there was neither cold nor hunger nor pain, for she was with God, unquote, then why not Agnes? Because otherwise, Agnes would just be dead. Quote, not an angel, you stupid lump, unquote, as the child's own mother, suspecting the worst of Margaret, says, quote, my girl is in the ground, unquote. And though the little match girl's fate might read as a happy ending to a tormented four-year-old, it's the grim description of the fairy tale girl's frozen feet, her, quote, blue and pimpled, unquote, skin that Margaret comes back to again and again in her, quote, confession, unquote. As hard as she tries and as good as she is at spinning her story mean reality, like Poor Dear has a way of intruding. It's a sad irony that what Margaret finally understands after such personal turmoil isn't necessarily the truth. As she tries out various versions of her story, it can be hard to tell which is real. And the question we're left with is, does it matter? If the point of the telling is to find a way to frame her own story to make it one worth inhabiting, maybe the telling itself opens the way to a happy ending. Why shouldn't there be brightness and joy after all? And that book again is titled Poor Deer, D-E-E-R, by Claire Olszewski.
Thank you so much, Lana. Margaret deals with guilt. To help us with the myriad of feelings, Brené Brown has written a user's guide to human emotions. It's entitled Atlas of the Heart, and this review is written by Belinda Luscombe. Why is it that people are quick to say they're jealous of someone, but will not admit to being envious? What's the difference between shame and guilt? Is hopelessness the same as despair? These are questions Brené Brown, the sociology professor turned best-selling author and leadership consultant, tries to answer in her new book, Atlas of the Heart. Although these may seem like trivial taxonomic issues to some, Brown believes the ability to precisely name feelings is a crucial skill, especially in days of division. If we want to find the way back to ourselves and one another, we need language, she writes, and the grounded confidence to both tell our stories and to be stewards of the stories that we hear. In surveys taken by 7,000 people over 5 years, Brown and her team found that on average, people can identify only 3 emotions as they are actually feeling them: happiness, sadness, and anger. For Brown, who made her name by illuminating the finer contours of humans' emotional landscape, this is not nearly enough. So she sets out to map 87 different emotions and experiences, pointing out the distinguishing features of each. The difference between guilt and shame, for example, as fans of Brown already know from her wildly popular TED Talks, her 5 previous number one bestsellers, her podcast, and Netflix lecture, is that guilt tells people they did something bad, while shame tells people they are something bad. The difference between envy and jealousy is that envy materializes when one wants something somebody else has. Looks, status, and wealth are the big trio, while jealousy is the feeling that a relationship is being threatened. Hopelessness is a fleeting fear that a task is too difficult, and despair is the feeling that life is too difficult, and so on. As a potential cartographer of the human experience, Brown is a solid candidate. She's the Dr. Fauci of feelings. She can take complex subjects that require years of study and explain them in a comprehensible and reassuring way. But unlike America's most famous public health official, Brown is allowed to be vulnerable. Indeed, she insists on it. Atlas flicks at her personal biography as a source of exposition. She mentions in passing that she came from a dysfunctional but high-performing family, and that she's a recovering alcoholic, a committed swimmer, and a perfectionist. This formula, very personal subject, plus rigorous research, has powered her work for 20 years. Atlas sold to HBO Max as an unscripted series even before it was published. It is her most reader-friendly book yet, but it may also be her thinnest. Examining 87 emotions in an easy-to-digest 300 pages is a tall order, and some readers will feel the stretch marks. A good portion of the book is oversized quotes, and there are some less than persuasive sections. Isn't bittersweet self-explanatory? What is irony doing in a list of emotions? The pleasure of reading Brown's previous work has been dawning self-recognition as she carefully and diligently loosened the knots that bound readers' hearts and hindered their ability to cope with their circumstances. This is more a book of quick hits, a reference guide to dip into when readers need a little reorientation. Brown's attempt to help people find their way to one another is laudable, but she has compiled an atlas when we need a GPS. Once again, that title is Atlas of the Heart and is written by Brené Brown.
Great, Kathleen. Well, we have following a Q&A with Jane Smalley, who quotes, reading novels is a form of emotional education, unquote. Jane Smalley, age 74, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist of 1,000 Acres and talks about storytelling, the power of curiosity, and the lessons horses teach. This interview is by Hugh Delahunty, and here we begin. He asks, in your new book, The Questions That Matter Most, you describe St. Louis as, quote, a perfect spot for a future novelist to grow up, unquote. How so? And Miss Smalley's answer is, there were so many things to look at, so many people to talk to, all different types, sociologically, and all kinds of different cultures. It made me interested in all the people around me. Next question. Are you from a family of storytellers? And her reply, yes, and the stories they told us kids were positive. But then I'd get up and go to the kitchen, and someone would say, quote, now that's not what happened. Here's what really happened, unquote. That was one of the best things for me. It told me that my mother and my cousins thought differently and had their own points of view. Next, your parents separated when you were one and you didn't see your father much. But you write that he gave you two important gifts, your height, 6'2", and his absence. And her answer, my father had mental issues, which people didn't talk about then the way we do now. But looking back, I think he would have been very domineering. My mom had a busy job as a newspaper editor, and my grandparents were quite easygoing, so I mostly did what I wanted to do. I wasn't wild or anything like that, but I had some cousins who were. I didn't mind observing them being wild. Another question. You've written several books about horses. What did riding teach you? And Miss Molly's reply, because horses are herd animals, they pay attention to what other beings around them are noticing. So one of the key aspects of learning to ride is to not be tense. For me, that was hard because I was basically a little scaredy cat. I've never been nervous about riding. It's physical things that make me nervous. Our next question. You talk in your book about reading as a pathway to freedom. What do you mean? A novel is a way for two people who don't know each other to interact intellectually and emotionally. So if I'm reading Pride and Prejudice, for example, I can relate to Elizabeth Bennet when she gets insulted by Mr. Darcy. That's what the novelist wants you to do. Often, when you're reading a novel that appeals to you, you feel a sense of connection to the author in a way that is different from any other form of literature. And as you become more aware of how the characters in the novel are feeling and thinking, you also become more aware of how you're feeling and thinking. So, reading novels is a form of emotional education. Our next question asks, didn't you get stuck while writing your novel, Good Faith? And her reply, yes, sometimes there's frustration. When 9/11 happened, a lot of writers looked at their work and said, quote, this is pointless, unquote. What I did was read other authors' works all the way back to The Tale of Genji, an 11th century Japanese novel. And the more I read, the more I realized that writing novels was a way of trying to sort out what's going on in your world. That really perked me up, and I got back to my novel. The next question asks, why do novelists get better with age? And her reply, well, first you have to learn how to write a novel. I knew what I wanted to write almost from the beginning of my career. But my first three books were, quote, practice, unquote, novels. I had to learn how to make a plot, how to pay attention to characters, how to organize the setting. That meant I couldn't do my magnum opus right out of the box. Our next question asks, the myth is that genius favors youth. But there are some artists who are just as creative when they get older. One of my favorite writers is Anthony Trollope. He just couldn't stop. He did a lot of stuff when he was young, a lot of stuff when he was middle age, and a lot of stuff when he was old. And the books are all interesting in different ways. Another example is Leonard Cohen. He wrote interesting songs all the way to the end. I think it's more difficult for songwriters because your voice changes. Novelists don't have that kind of performance anxiety. And our last question asks, what keeps you going? And her reply, curiosity. I hear something new and think, I'd like to figure that one out. And the more I find out, the more interesting it gets. And I think, oh, I could turn that into a novel. And so once more, our novel is titled The Questions That Matter Most by Jane Smiley, spelled S-M-I-L-E-Y.
Thank you. Since we're thinking about emotions, what about anger? We have questions for Caitlin Moran, the feminist author on the paucity of the patriarchy and the overlooked population addressed in her new book, What About Men? Our first question is, did writing this book change your mind about men? If you're a 15-year-old boy, in the last 10 years, female empowerment is all you have ever heard. Their dads know this is a recent and mild corrective to 10,000 years of patriarchy. The boys just don't have that perspective, and so they are angry. Question: is it true that it's easier to be a woman than a man now? In one respect, in that we women are able to talk about problems of gender, and men still seem not to have invented that technology in a way that isn't damaging, angry, and woman-blaming, we can confess that we've got a problem. We can talk to each other about it. And then there's this amazing centuries-old thing called feminism that means that even if your mother or your friends don't have the solution, someone's written a blog about it. Someone's written a movie about it. Beyoncé has written a song about it. Men don't seem to have got to the point of being able to go, "This scares me. Does anybody else suffer from this problem? Let's form a campaign and bring a legislation that changes our lives forever." Question: you write that the patriarchy is messing over men as much as women. Is it patriarchy, or is it changes in technology and global trade? I think all men presume they're in the patriarchy and they're winning. No. There's 10 guys at the top of this tree who are doing okay. But you're being messed over as well because you're the guy that's scared he's about to be punched when you go to school. You're the one that's being told not to cry. You're the one that doesn't have paternity leave. To what do you attribute the rise of people like Jordan Peterson and Andrew Tate? The only people who are talking about masculinity at the moment are people like Peterson and Tate. I think the offer of masculinity they make is not only retrogressive and damaging, but simply won't work. I don't know anyone in the world whose anxiety, depression, and unhappiness has been solved by power. What they need is empowerment. I wanted to write a book that encouraged the liberal men to start talking about men again. You advance the theory that young boys' fine motor skills set them back emotionally. Can you elaborate? Boys' fine motor skills develop later than girls. So very early on, there's a very negative association for boys with writing and reading. In their teens, they're reading graphic novels, whereas girls are reading stuff about normal lives. Why is there no culture of books about normal boys crossing from childhood to adult? It seems like they need it. You advise young men to make sure that sex takes place in a committed relationship. Do you find it surprising that you're aligning yourself with a more traditional view? My big inspiration for writing the chapter was that young men don't want to talk about what's prevalence of sexual assault for teenage girls, but rather that they might get falsely accused of rape. You are vanishingly unlikely to be falsely accused of rape. But if this is something you're worried about, then let me give you some very straightforward advice. Make sure your sex partner is someone you trust and that you think is unlikely to start lying about you. What do you think your chances are as a noted feminist of getting young men to read your book? My favorite thing is to find an area that's taboo, difficult, and awkward, and to find a way of starting a conversation. That book, once again, is What About Men? It's by Caitlin Moran.
All right, you have been listening about books on Owl Radio. You can listen on your computer or smartphone, and you may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed between 8 and 10 p.m. this evening. This is Lana Collins with co-host
Kathleen Shaw
saying goodbye
from Owl Radio.